Going to read the Bible now. If you'd like a Bible in your hand, please grab one from the stacks at the back of the church. This is the correct moment to leap out of your seat and rush down the aisle and borrow a Bible for this study. Please do that now. We're going to turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, which is as far as we've got. And we're only going to do two verses this morning. In fact, we could spend weeks on this, but we're just going to spend one Sunday because it is phenomenally powerful and deep passage. Peter's talked last week about Jesus Christ as the cornerstone. He's the block, the carefully, perfectly prepared block on which we build our lives. We line ourselves up on Jesus. And he says, if you don't line yourself up on Jesus, you end up tripping over him and stumbling and falling. And he leads us on to the next level this morning in verse 9. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. One of my favourite books is by Douglas Copeland. It's called Microsurfs. He's a very modern author. Don't read him if you like sort of Jane Austen. This is very different. Microsurfs is all about software engineers who work for Microsoft and then they form their own company. And he does kind of parody them a little bit, and they're very geekish, but it's a great book. It's an insight into the mind of younger generation. I cannot commend it highly enough. And one of my favorite bits in the book is two of the characters. It's about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're talking to each other. They're in the next room to each other, but they're talking over the internet because, well, that's what they do. They're still on a computer that time of day or night. And they're talking to each other next year. I know Magnus and I do it all the time, actually, here. But I've now put Skype in, so we don't even need to get out of our seats. We can talk face-to-face. But these guys are doing this at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's birthday's coming up. So one of them writes to the other. He says, what do you want for your birthday? And his friend says, the key to the next level. The key to the next level, which probably means nothing to those of you who aren't gaming on computers. But for those of you who never played games on computer, most computer games, a lot of computer games, take you from one level to another, from one scene to another, but there's often a hidden key that you've got to find that will unlock the door to the next level. And what this guy wants in his life is the key to the next level in his life. I thought that was fantastic. What a tremendous desire to have the key to the next level. To find the hidden dimension in life, to find the door to the TARDIS and step into something that's just in a different dimension. Who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want it? I was listening to John Polkinghorne on the radio last week, a few weeks ago. He's a professional scientist and an Anglican minister. He was a professor of mathematical physics at Cambridge, specialising in particle physics. But he felt the call to the ministry, and when that career finished, he became an Anglican minister. And he said this, science is like a telescope to see into the mysteries of the universe. But faith and science together are like binoculars. You see better in more depth and in full vision when you have the two lenses instead of the one. You need both. You need both to see the universe in all its glory. And to see fuller into God's presence, we've got to go into this Bible verse, because something unique was happening in the Roman Empire. In a quiet, or rather troubled backwater of the rather choppy and difficult backwater of the Roman Empire, a quiet revolution had broken out, although the Romans didn't realize it at this point. And the Savior of the world had been born in a stable in Bethlehem, had been crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem, had risen from the dead on the third day, and more people were finding him and committing their lives to him. And this was going on while the Roman Empire and Roman emperors were concerned about other things like defense budgets and stuff and politics. But it was happening. But they didn't realize its significance. And Peter is writing to a group of Christians in one of the farther-flung provinces of the Roman Empire. And Peter knows what's happening. Peter has lived this revolution since the moment Jesus set out preaching from the shores of the Lake Galilee. He's lived it. He's seen the Spirit of God fall powerfully on the church. He's seen wonderful things take place. And he's now writing to Christians to encourage them, to tell them they are part of something much bigger. And so he begins in verse 9. You are a chosen people. You are a chosen people. Strange thing to say to a group of ordinary, beleaguered people on the edge of the Roman Empire. They were few in number. They were fearful. We'll be unpacking this as we go through the book, what they were fearing, the kind of pressures they were under. You wouldn't bet money on this odd religious sect becoming an empire-wide religion that today has 2 billion followers. You wouldn't have believed it if you'd been living at the time. But he says to the people of God, this group of people on the edge of the Roman Empire, he says, you are very special. You are chosen people. You are a chosen people. You're really something else. We have stories about people who are really something else, don't we? The ugly duckling, who's really a beautiful swan. In modern filmology, it's usually a CIA assassin with amnesia, isn't it? But that's probably not a very good example to use in this case. But you are something that people round about you can't see, says Peter. You are something that people don't know about. You are a chosen people. The old authorized version calls people of God a peculiar people, in a very archaic use of the word. We had a wonderful, wonderful experience of that out in Brazil when an American came to preach. A guy had been a missionary and spoke Portuguese fluently, but for some reason he didn't want to preach in Portuguese. So he asked my colleagues to translate his sermon. None of them really wanted to do it. So in the end, they passed it on to Avelino, who's a Portuguese colleague, still speaks beautiful English. And Avelino said, yeah, okay, I'll translate the sermon for him. So this American stands up and he begins, the people of God are a peculiar people. Which Avelino translates, povo de Deus and povo esquisito, which literally means the people of God are a weird people. And they got complicated because the American knew enough Portuguese to know that Avelino had mistranslated it. So he said, I didn't say that. I said, they're a peculiar people. And Avelino said, yeah, that's what I said. They're a weird people. No, it's not what it means. Of course it's what it means. So these two then have this long argument in English before this bemused congregation. I have no idea what's going on. While my colleagues quietly die laughing in the back row. But we are not a weird people. We are a chosen people. We are a special people, a special group. We have a hidden identity. And you're probably picking up through the book of 1 Peter. He relies very heavily on the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 43, verse 21, says, "The people I formed for myself that they may proclaim my praise." Peter says, you are that people that God has formed for himself. You're that special. You are a chosen people. Back to 1 Peter chapter 2. You are a chosen people. And you are a royal priesthood. I have to tell you, there's some discussion among the theologians how to translate the second phrase, a royal priesthood. Some translations have a kingdom of priests and kings, or a royal priesthood. The truth is, the Greek can mean either. Royal can be an adjective or a noun here. It kind of goes back to Exodus chapter 19. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. A kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And Peter says, going back to Peter, you are a royal priesthood. And that gives me tremendous insight into my day. It tells me I'm not what I appear to everybody else. I'm an undercover priest. And so are you. You're an undercover priest cunningly disguised as a university student, as a factory worker, as a carer, as a home husband, a home wife, house husband. You're a priest cunningly disguised as a job seeker. The world only sees part of who you are. You live in the world, but you're really a priest to God. Priests had access to God in the Old Testament. You and I, we have 24/7 access to God as priests. We have the access all areas pass to heaven. We have the open door to God because we're priests. You can wake up in the middle of the night and you can talk to God. You can wake up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed just like me in the morning and talk to God. You can lay down at night on your bed before you drop off. You can talk to God. You can talk to God when you're walking down the street, when you're driving your car, when you're sitting at your desk. You can talk to God wherever you are because you are a priest. The world might not know that. In fact, it won't know that. But Peter says you are a priest. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you are a priest. I don't live to work. I work to live as a priest. My ultimate vocation is as a priest to God. Now, I might be a very good professional, and you might be a very good professional in what you do. You might be a great, whatever you do, road sweeper, dustman, cleaner, carer, teacher. I've been just looking around all the different professions. We've got all sorts of professions here. And that's good, and you do the best you can because being a good profession is a vocation from God, a vocation to do what you do. But you are also a priest. You minister to God throughout the day because that's what you are, undercover. You are an undercover priest. It's a calling, a corporate calling. You can quietly talk to God at any minute. If people listen to sermons online, and so they miss the first part of the service. And we had a lovely testimony from one of our worship leaders this morning, for those who are listening online, of how he had a back problem, and his 10-year-old son prayed for him, and he was healed. We have a church where 8-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 10-year-olds pray, and God hears their prayers, and he answers them and blesses them. It doesn't matter about age. You are a priest if you're a follower of Jesus Christ. God hears, and it's exciting. You can be a priest anywhere. You can be a priest on a hospital bed. You can be a priest in a prison cell. One of my colleagues was converted in a prison cell and became a missionary with us in Brazil. You can be a priest while you're driving your car, while you're doing the shopping. You are that. That's what you are. God expects you to be a priest and to be praying. I know we make a big fuss about in big prayer meetings and praying in church. That's all well and good. That's great. But it's not the mainstay. The mainstay happens when you are exercising your priestly ministry as you go about your daily life. And I say, how exciting is that? God waits to hear your prayers every day. And one of the things we need to do is to learn to fill those gaps in our days with prayer. Because that's what God wants us to do. God wants us to do that. You are a kingdom of priests. And I'm looking out this morning on a kingdom of priests. And I have to say, it looks good. It looks good. It encourages my heart. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, that means set aside, people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you hadn't received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Many in the early church had a checkered past. Many in the current church have a checkered past. And I've heard some wonderful stories. Ex-gangsters, colleagues of the Cray, an ex-colleague of the Cray twins and the Richardson gang, the most notorious criminal gangs in the 20th century, saw one of their ex-colleagues stand up and say how Jesus Christ had turned his life around. Fantastic. He was baptized with police officers waiting to arrest him at the close of the service. And he went to prison. And he's put in a prison cell with his biggest enemy. They knew these guys hate each other, so he was made to share a cell with his biggest enemy. And at the time, going back a number of decades, his biggest enemy had left prison and was working as a missionary in the Far East. You know? Some of God's people have a checkered past. Some of us have quite boring pasts. A few of God's people are very high up in society, but most of us are just common day slobs like you and me. But we are chosen by God. We are God's people. We've been brought from darkness into life. We are messed up people molded into spiritual ministers. All of us. Messed up people molded into ministers. We're studying Jacob in our evening services, and it's a bit of an eye-opener. God's promise for all humanity comes through a really mixed-up character. The guy's a mess. His family's a mess. And it just goes from bad to worse. And you think, what on earth is happening? If I were God, I wouldn't have done it this way. But God's God, you know. God takes messed up people, and he turns them around. Maybe I've got this on my mind because Susan and I went to see Les Miserables on in a cinema this week, which is one of the great stories of grace. Fantastic story of grace. Whether you like the musical or not, I don't care. The story is a wonderful, it's a fiction, it's a novel, but it's a story of a man who's on the slide, who's about to go down into the depths when suddenly a Christian minister, a Christian priest, treats him with out, outrageous grace and turned his life around. It's a great story. And the word grace appears so often in the film. It appears in our life too. We have been met with the grace of God. And as always, Peter has hidden references to the Old Testament. Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," you will be called sons of the living God. And in Hosea 2:23, "I will plant Israel for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called, not my loved one. I will say to those called, not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God." You are my people, and we say you are my God. Paul uses the same idea in Romans 9, verses 24-25. As he says, "Even among us whom he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles." And then he quotes the Hosea passage, which is also on Peter's mind. Jews and non-Jews, all called together. This was what the early apostles just couldn't get their heads around. And the apostle Paul, to the day he died, couldn't get over this wondrous grace that the non-Jews had had the door to heaven opened to them by Jesus and had come into God's blessing. The blessing which originally was offered to Abraham through Abraham. And suddenly the whole world has been offered the chance of redemption in Jesus. Fantastic opportunity. And Paul, in one of my favourite passages, in 1 Corinthians 26:29, "Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. You're a load of riffraff. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him." The Romans, they were banqueting in Rome and they were eating their lark's tongues and everything else. And they were having these huge banquets and quaffing this expensive wine. And they were living the life of luxury and they're down among the common people. Day by day, one by one, ordinary people were hearing about Jesus and saying, "Do you know what? I'm going to follow Jesus." And ordinary people were becoming priests to God, while the elites fought about power and money and inheritances and marriage and all kinds of things. They were up there having their high life, getting their names written in the history books, while the real history was going on down below at street level with ordinary people turning to Jesus and becoming priests. Isn't that just so exciting? Isn't that so exciting? So that's it then. What is the next level? What is the next level? It's this. We become priests and kings. We can have that off the screen now, I think. The next level is where you and I accept Jesus into our hearts and become priests. That is the next level, which in truth, that character in Douglas Copeland's Microserfs is longing for, though he doesn't know it. The next level has a key, and that key is Jesus Christ. And as in those stupid video games that people play in, games on computer, you know, they grasp the key and go to the next level. In real life, you take hold of Jesus and you go on to the next level. That's what happens. The human race is offered the key to the next level because the human race is invited to receive Jesus Christ into their hearts and follow him and become God's people. And suddenly you go from a nobody into a somebody. You go from a nothing in society to someone who's a follower of Jesus Christ, who's a priest to God. And I have seen that happen so many times. I've been privileged to work with some of the poorest people on the planet. And I've seen the change in their lives. People who are poor, barely read or write, some of them, living in South American slums or in or landless people fighting for land. And I've seen their lives change. I've seen the dignity that floods their life. They've been kicked around at the bottom of society all their life. And suddenly they wake up one morning with Jesus Christ in their hearts and they are priests. And they begin to pray and God begins to answer their prayers. And do you know what? They're still poor. They still struggle to survive. They still have a hand-to-mouth existence, but they are walking tall. Because they know that away from this outward garment of poverty, they are special people, chosen by God, priests to God. But we live in a dangerous world, and bad things can happen to Christians. So next week, undercover priests require cautious lifestyles sometimes. We'll unpack that next week. But before we do that, we'll pray. And if the band would please join me on the platform.